Jedi Squadron is a podcast run by the Anime Secrets website. Check us out at animesecrets.org for more anime, video game, tokusatsu, and now Star Wars content. Remember to follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you listen to podcasts today.
Hello, new Padawans, and welcome to the Jedi Squadron podcast. Here, you will be taking lessons in the many pieces of the Star Wars universe, whether it be the movies, animated series, video games, comics, and etc. This is your training into becoming a Star Wars fan as part of the Jedi Squadron. May your training go well, and may the Force be with you, young Padawans. What's going on, Star Wars Nation? This is the Jedi Squadron podcast presented by AnimeSecrets.org. I'm your host, Nathan Dessau. And today, in our little journey to Ahsoka, we are doing Rebels Season 3. We got Riz on again.
Hey guys, how's it going?
Before we get started, as per usual, this is being recorded in the midst of the Screen Actors Guild and Writers Guild strikes that are still ongoing. We want to make it clear that we are not paid to promote any of this content. We are doing this strictly to show our support for these actors and writers without their hard work, the greatness of these shows would not be possible. We stand firmly with both of them, and we will continue to stand with them during this difficult time. We wanted to get that out of the way. And with that said, we are doing a Rebel Season 3. Were you going to say something, Riz?
I was going to say, yeah, the more I see about the writer strike and the actor strike, it's just amazing to me how thoughtless the industry's being towards them and the studios are being towards them. I don't know if you've seen it lately, but these actors and writers are not even getting compensated for things they worked on. Like if it moves to Netflix or if somebody else picks it up, it's called residual royalties.
Yep.
And I've seen multiple actors now posting screenshots or photos of checks they get from companies like Netflix and all the others. And the amount varies from a penny to 0 cents as a check, like amount dollar check.
I mean, that could be the case in with shows that actually were on, that aired on TV too. Like I read a article about how Josh Peck, you know, he apparently never got any residuals for Drake and Josh, which was like the big thing. I mean, even the non-Netflix shows, they're still pretty bad in some cases.
Oh, it's all bad. I'm just using Netflix as the example. But all that to say, for any studios that might come across this podcast, dude, do better.
Yeah.
Like, these people put their heart and souls into these projects for us, for entertainment, for the general consumer, and they deserve compensation and their due.
Yep. And that goes double for the writers, because I mean, their skills and ability to write are what make this, shows like what we're about to review possible.
And even the other members of staff, executive producers and extras in the background, everyone deserves their fair share of credit, not just the top line executive people who are looking for their own bottom line.
Yep. Like, you know, in Avengers Endgame, we're not just talking about like all the big name Avengers. We're talking about all those nameless Wakanda soldiers that are charging in the background.
Yeah. Or all the Jedi in the background of Order 66 that were killed.
Yep. So, I don't know if we could say the clones in Order 66, since in the movie they're all CGI, but
still. Yeah. But the guy that they based it off of.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, for Christ's sake, David Fielding has come out and said he was only paid $150 total to be the face of Zordon in Mighty Morphin Power Rangers and Beyond. And he's never seen a residual. They never called him back. But they used his face throughout the run of like 6 seasons of a TV show. That's really kind of dirty to me.
Yeah. These studios just need to do better.
Yeah. But you know what, Nate? It's time to talk about something a little bit less depressing.
Yep.
And talk about what I think is the best season of the four.
Yeah, same with me.
I hold final judgment on that until I finish season four again. But I seem to remember thinking, even last time, that season three is the best of the four.
Yeah, that's weird because, like, I was watching Star Wars Explained. He's one of the best Star Wars YouTubers, and like he and his wife are doing a like little review series on Rebels 2, and like they were saying that they really liked Rebels season 3. Their review just dropped, and apparently there were some comments saying that like a lot of people didn't like season 3, like they consider it underrated. And I'm just thinking, like, what? Like, this Dude. Is the best. This is oh the best God. Season of the show.
It, so many things happen in the season that, honestly, if you asked me, like, 2 weeks ago before I saw this season, mm-hmm. I would have told you this stuff happened in season four.
Mm-hmm.
But the events that I remember the most fondly happened in season three. And I think we can segue into one of them right now. Yeah. And that is, I think, the best part of season three to me is Sabine's story arc, character development, the Mandalorian stuff.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's the best part of season three of Star Wars. And I've talked to a friend or two of mine about it, and they have told me their favorite part is the Darth Maul story and the Ezra descending into the dark side a bit more story, but those are great stories. They're solid, but Sabine's story just hit different for me.
Yeah.
So, go ahead.
Just to clarify, but before we continue, like, for those, you know, who may not have seen season three and just want to get a general recap, like, should we give the recap?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. And then, so the previous season ended with the rebels setting up a secret base on Adalon. There was a big skirmish between Kanan, Ezra, Maul, and Vader. Ahsoka was supposedly killed in it. Kanan got blinded when he took a lightsaber to the eye, and Ezra's blaster-like lightsaber was destroyed, I'm pretty sure. And
yeah,
it ended with Ezra getting the Sith holocron. And then we pick up 6 months later. Ezra has shorter hair now all of a sudden. And he now has a green lightsaber, which he's made for himself, which is like a normal lightsaber. And we get a lot, you know, we have a, there's a lot of episodes where, like, you know, Ezra's tempted to use the Sith holocron to try and defeat the Sith, and he's working with Darth Maul, although it turns out that Maul was just using him to try and figure out the location of Obi-Wan, which we'll get more on that later. Aside from that, we get the big debut of Grand Admiral Thrawn in canon, which it was a really big deal because, like, for those who may not have paid a lot of attention to EU content before Disney brought it, like, Grand Admiral Thrawn is like a massive fan favorite. Like, there was this trilogy of novels that I grew up reading where he was probably, like, next to Palpatine and Vader, like, the most beloved villain in Star Wars. And to see him on the show and, like, be canonized, like, this was a really big deal because, like, you finally get to see him something. And, like, I think the most that we got to see aside from, like, books was that, there was, like, a computer game called TIE Fighter, which he appeared. But even then, like, it was just still shots of him sitting with dialogue. Like, there was nothing that you could actually see him moving. So bringing Grand Admiral Thrawn in was a big deal.
And especially given Grand Admiral Thrawn was kind of brought in to replace the Inquisitor group from the first two seasons. That's, like, the... he's not the big bad because that's Palpatine and Vader, but the villain you see most often and you interact with, he's the threat for the characters most of the time.
Yep.
So I think they did good bringing in Thrawn here.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be honest. I've never read any of the Thrawn books from the EU or even from the new canonized stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I'm planning on getting to it at some point in the next couple of weeks. But yeah, I just feel like Thrawn was the good call here.
Yep. The big... we also see Wedge join the rebellion. Sabine recruits him and another pilot from the Imperial Academy, which is great. I love Wedge. Love seeing him more often. Like Riz was saying, we get, you know, a lot of episodes revolving around Sabine's backstory. Like the previous season established that what Mandalorian clan she was part of and how she was part of a family of people that opposed Satine Kurt, I can't remember how to pronounce her last name, but you know, her rule. And then in this season, well, for starters, Ezra, during like a little skirmish with Darth Maul, he obtains the Darksaber, which, if you guys have watched Clone Wars, you'll know that that's a huge part of the Mandalorian culture, because whoever wields that saber is ruler of Mandalore. And
Sabine got the saber.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, Sabine gets it, and she's being challenged to go to Mandalore to try and lure the Mandalorians to the rebellion cause. And we find out that not only did Sabine designed a weapon that was used to like kill Mandalorians, and that's what caused her to be exiled, like excommunicated entirely. And
yeah,
we get a whole saga of episodes where they return to Mandalore, and you know, she meets back with her family, and they have to deal with I can't remember what the guy's name was. He wasn't in Clone Wars, although he apparently was supposed to be in a saga of Clone Wars episodes that was never produced before the show got canceled. Although it was apparently those episodes were adapted into a Darth Maul comic series.
You talking about Gar Saxon?
Yeah, Gar Saxon.
Yeah, Gar Saxon, I don't think he appears anywhere else. I might be wrong about that.
Yeah, but like I said, he was supposed to appear in some Clone Wars episodes near the end, but then the show got canceled, so they adapted it into the comics. So, but that happened, and Sabine, after, you know, defeating Gar Saxon and his people and, you know, rejoining her family, she leaves the team for a little bit, although she does come back in the finale to help when Thrawn and everybody is attacking the rebel base. We also see a big event where the rebellion is officially declared, when Mon Mothma comes forward and declares her resignation from the rebellion. And we're seeing the Rebel Alliance become much more of a clearer thing, where Mon Mothma, who, if you guys know about Star Wars lore, you'll know that she is the one who founded the rebellion. She declares her resignation from the Imperial Senate and forms the rebellion. And we see her. We see General Jan Dodonna, who people who have seen A New Hope will know that he's the commander of the Yavin base. The series ends. We get one really great episode, but we'll talk more about that one in a minute. We get a big two-parter where the Adelon base is finally attacked, and everyone manages to escape, but it ends on more of like a bittersweet note.
And a couple of notes on other stuff that came up in this season. Kanan and Ezra meet a new character named Bindu.
Yep, Bindu.
Who is not a Jedi, he's not a Sith, but he is a Force user, I think is the best way to put it. He just is in the Force. Like, he doesn't believe in the factions, he doesn't believe in one without the other. He believes in a true balance that the Jedi can't accept and the Sith cannot accept.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a pretty big deal as well, to have him. Something, I don't know if we've really talked about it in the last two podcasts, Nate, but I do want to talk real quick about Rebels thematics across the different seasons and talk a little bit about what each season's overall theme has been up until now.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, in season one, the big theme for us, so I've used Rebels as a way for us as the audience to understand the struggle that the Rebels went through until A New Hope. And in season one, we're given a very intimate insight into a single cell of the rebellion. And they have no connection to anyone else, really. I mean, you see Hera talking to Fulcrum, but it's not really clear who Fulcrum is, what's going on, where are these orders coming from. And that's kind of done, in my opinion, to let us get a feel for what is it like before the rebellion formed. What are people doing to sow their displeasure with the Empire? And, you know, there's a lot of different dialogue in season one where Kanan and Hera are debating heavily on the Ghost Crew's role in the larger rebellion that we form in later seasons.
Yep.
And Kanan is a very big proponent of not getting involved with the big rebellion and doing things their way as a small family. He doesn't want to get involved, mainly because he's still dealing with the PTSD, I think, of mm-hmm. Order 66 and the clones betraying them and the Jedi all dying and him having survivor's guilt. So I think he sees getting back into the rebellion as a return to the hell that he is trying to escape. So that's kind of the gist of season one. Season two is more about kind of collaboratively working with other cells, but not really having a lot of structure and building that structure up and seeing more of it. So we see Commander Sato, we see Ahsoka, they recruit Rex. And now we're seeing multiple missions happening at the same time across any given period of time.
Mm-hmm.
So you can see like Ahsoka walking off and saying, yeah, y'all deal with this. I'm going to go deal with something else. We'll meet up later and debrief. And you get the idea that there's other stuff going on beyond one cell. And that's important because by the end of season two, these cells have come together to form what I would call a rebellion faction.
Yep.
Now, this isn't the formalized rebellion that we see in A New Hope on the Battle of Yavin and all that. This is still fragmented because not all the different groups are together yet. And so, I mean, and that's really made obvious in season three, but we'll get that out in a second.
Yeah, and it's kind of, and what you're saying is kind of backed up. I think it was in season two where they have to break into an Imperial facility and they steal a bunch of Y-wings. Like,
yep.
They say that those Y-wings are going to Dodonna's unit or faction or something. So that would imply there are these factions and every now and then maybe they'll work with each other, but they're not allied completely. Just
I viewed that as they are doing trades back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe Dodonna had something that Hera's group needed. Maybe Hera had something he needed. So they make trades to, you know, sustain themselves. But also, I think they were all communicating before, but they weren't able to do it publicly because they didn't want to reveal how big the rebellion was becoming.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't until season three, like you said, Nate, when Mon Mothma declares he's resigned from the Senate, that we get the whole shebang beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so that leads us to, in season three, life as a larger place, like a larger rebellion with a base, but you're still not quite united. But by the end of season three, now we're at the point where we're at the rebellion. This is the rebellion at the end of season three. In its final form, in my opinion.
Yeah, and it's leading us to what we ultimately see the rebellion become as, like, a force that is ultimately possibly capable of doing severe damage to the Empire, like we see in A New Hope.
Yeah. And I think throughout it, we're also seeing the growth of Kanan and Ezra throughout. So Ezra goes from season one being just a force wielder, but not really, I wouldn't call him a Padawan in season one, really.
No.
Like, he's kind of a Padawan, but he's not really comfortable with the lightsaber. He's not really comfortable with the idea of order and all that. Season two, he's a definite Padawan. Season three, he's still a Padawan, but now he's flirting with the dark side. And he has to have that big internal struggle between having Kanan be his mentor and having Maul be his mentor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a piece of time when Ezra was considering Maul a little bit more.
Yeah.
But all that to say, there's a lot of inner stuff going on with this series outside of what we've seen in the episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's all very important for context.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, that's the high level view of season three. Nate, do you want to hop back to the Sabine train, or do you have something else now?
Well, the other thing before we like talk about the Sabine thing, like, and this is the reason why I really love this season the most, is that like, I think that this was the season where this show is finally walking on its own two feet because, you know, one of the things that I've said, like, okay, I didn't hate the first two seasons, but I do think that the first two seasons, like, especially with season one, the show, it wasn't too dependent as I think people make it out to be, but it's still tried a little too hard to bring in older characters. It was a little bit better in season two, but even then you still got two characters who were main characters from Clone Wars. Like, this is the season where I feel like the show is confident enough for us liking their own original characters enough to where they don't have to bring in a lot of old characters. Like, okay, Ahsoka and Vader are not in this season at all. I think Tarkin is in it maybe once or twice, but not
enough. Tarkin's in a hologram.
Yeah. Yes, Maul plays a huge part in this, but I give that a huge free pass because, one, I think Dave Filoni can call Maul his own character, and I already said that in the previous podcast. But the other reason is that you were wrapping up Maul's story in this season. I can't think of another way that you could have wrapped up his story, so I make that exception.
Not only that, but Maul's involvement was not a superficial, oh look, it's Maul, he's here for fan service. And that's kind of what the complaint was about when we saw Leia or R2-D2, C-3PO, is they're here for fan service to get us, the fans, more excited about Rebels. But Maul, while he's a nostalgia grab for some people, he also has a very compelling story that's been kind of building since the Clone Wars, I think season four?
Five. Yeah, he came in season four.
Yeah. So that's been building for a while, and I think it's very nice that he finally got his closer at the end here.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll talk more about his closer and that entire journey in a little bit, I think. Because that deserves a lot more do you discuss than I feel.
Yeah. With that said, like, did you want to say more about Sabine's story?
Yeah, I think so. Normally at this point in our podcast for these reviews, we've been talking more about our favorite parts of a season in Rebels. And so I'm going to put out for candidacy, my favorite piece of this season is the Sabine Mandalorian arc. It's not without its faults, unfortunately. I'll be the first to admit that. But overall, it's one of the strongest parts of the season. And so I'll give you the parts I didn't like at first. Mm-hmm. So I had a hard time understanding how the Darksaber ended up on the planet Dathomir.
Mm-hmm.
Because the last time I think that I've seen the Darksaber before that in the chronological timeline, and correct me where I'm wrong here, Nate, but I think the last user was Maul.
Yeah, I don't remember him using it during the Siege of Mandalore arc. I think he just used his own saber when he was fighting Ahsoka, but I do remember him using it to kill Satine.
Yeah.
In that little arc, which, I mean, I'll always remember that arc. That might be my favorite Clone Wars arc. But yeah, that's the last time I remember him using it.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, Clone Wars, even though it introduced the Darksaber, like, it doesn't really go much into, like, the Clone Wars was just kind of about the Darksaber. Like, this show, like, really expands the lore behind that, actually. But yeah, I see what you're saying.
Okay, I just found out what happened there. So Maul does use it quite a bit, but a lot of the content where Maul uses the Darksaber and how it ends up on the planet Dathomir is covered in the events of the Second Battle of Dathomir, which is a comic.
Oh. Which,
I'm looking for the name of it right now in the Wikipedia article. I'm on Star Wars Phantom right now.
I haven't read this, but I did get some information from Star Wars Explained, which, okay, I know that I keep citing him a lot, but I do legitimately think he's a great Star Wars YouTuber. And by the way, if you're listening to this, Mr. Alex Damon, I'm a really huge fan of your work. It was a comic called The Sons of Dathomir, which...
Yep. And that's exactly where it came from.
That was actually how Gar Saxon originally appeared. And those were all apparently based on storyboards and scripts from Clone Wars episodes that were supposed to come out in season 6. And I guess they were going to do a season 7 after season 6 before Disney decided to cancel the show. So, so I do think that they had plans to, so they would have explained why that would have happened.
Yeah.
I don't know. You just adapted the Sons of Dathomir into season 7 instead of that. Okay, I love season 7 of Clone Wars, but why did you have to do that Martez sisters arc? Couldn't you have done the Sons of Dathomir? We'll talk about that when we get to it.
Yeah, but, despite me now knowing how the Darksaber ended up on Dathomir and why it was abandoned on Dathomir, I still wish we had more context for this in the animated series without having to go to the comics or the books. So you're probably going to disagree with me here, Nate, but my opinion is the main story of Star Wars should be told in the TV shows and the movies. While the books and comics are here more to supplement other stuff, but the main things that are happening should probably get covered in the TV shows and the movies instead.
I don't know how I feel about the, like, I think the comics are good for, like, you know, big adventures that might, you know, explain, like, some minor things. Like, I might disagree with you about the books. I do think that the books can be used for, like, some legitimately big things. But I do agree that, like, if we're going to understand some big events, it should be communicated through us, through either the TV shows or the movies. Because, I mean, I don't know, like, one of my favorite guys that I watch on YouTube, not necessarily related to Star Wars, but, like, he says, you shouldn't have to read the book to understand the movie or the TV show or something. So
exactly.
I can agree with what you're saying.
And like, you know, it wouldn't have been too hard to have Maul do a flashback at some point in that little arc where he thinks back to the second battle of Dathomir.
Mm-hmm.
It could have been a quick 10-20 second thing where he just reminisces about how things ended. And it'd have been great as an explanation to explain how he went from that to being on Malachor later.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there's a small missed opportunity there. But in the grand scheme, this isn't something that I'm going to harp on a lot. It is just something I wanted to throw out as like a... I wish I had this context outside of having to go look on Wikipedia.
Yeah.
But the rest of the Darksaber arc and the Mandalorian stuff is amazing. Because if you guys have been following our podcast series this far, you'll know that Nate and I have been kind of clamoring for more Sabine content and more of her backstory and character development. Because this is the first time we get any real focus on her. Like, before we have these episodes, all we know about Sabine is she's Mandalorian, she's an artist, she's sarcastic, and she's not, like, a traditional Mando in personality. That's all we know about her.
Mm-hmm.
In this season, we learn her big guilt is building a weapon that the Empire ended up using on her own people, which got her excommunicated, and that's a big deal for her because that's the crux of why she doesn't go back home, why she doesn't talk to her family. And there's a lot of great conflict there, especially when she is told by Kanan, hey, look, you have the Darksaber now. That is a symbol to reunite Mandalore, and we, the Rebellion, need allies. And if you, a rebel, can learn to wield the Darksaber and then inspire Mandalore to help us, that's a big boon to our cause currently, which is putting Sabine at odds with her past because she doesn't want to confront what happened. But she has to, and it's really kind of awesome how when Kanan's trying to train her to use a Darksaber. So for those that don't know, the Darksaber is basically a lightsaber.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a black blade, and it's more like a sword in form, but it's definitely a lightsaber. And so you have to be trained to use it either with the Force or with actual training. So I thought it was really cool to see Kanan training a non-Force user to use what we've come to know in the fandom to be a Force primary weapon. And I thought it was interesting that he goes into the detail to tell her, feel the energy and how it bends and how it moves and make it an extension of you. I thought those lessons were really insightful because we kind of take for granted how lightsaber battles have happened up until now. Like, we're more focused on the it's pretty type of thing rather than what's the technique underlying it all?
Yeah.
So I thought that was all really awesome. And I thought Sabine's return to Mandalore was handled really well. Also, unrelated but related, Rouse sift from being a prisoner from last season to being... to becoming an ally and a member of the Rebellion. I thought that was pretty cool as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Finn Rao was pretty cool in this season.
Yeah. But no, I thought it was nice to see the family. And then like Kanan said, look, they got into a bit of a pickle in the Ant finale and Ezra needed to get help. So Ezra left Adalon to go search for allies to help. And he uses Sabine's connection to Mandalore to bring help. And that lets this segment of the rebellion escape Adelon and join the larger rebellion that Mon Mothma was forming. And yeah, it's just really powerful stuff to me.
Mm-hmm.
But I've talked for a good bit there, Nate. I'm going to let you have the floor.
Yeah, I think you've highlighted, like, I agree with everything you have to say about Sabine's arc. One episode that I want to bring to attention, and it's actually not the one that we're both going to talk about that one in a little bit, but the big one that I want to bring up is the sixth episode of this season. It's called The Last Battle. So in this episode,
Roger.
Yeah. the crew goes to some old, like, to a place where, like, there's some old Clone Wars era stuff so that they can salvage whatever they can. And that planet turns out to be populated by a bunch of old separatist droids that weren't shut down. And they're led by this one tactical droid. And he wants to settle a score, like, okay, we may have lost the war, but I mean, here's one clone here. I'm going to kill him and, like, you know, so I can go out on, like, one last hurrah. And it's so great because, you know, we get to see, you know, Rex do his thing just like the old times. But what's really cool is how Ezra kind, like, I don't know if it was intended to do it this way, but Ezra really kind of highlights just how screwed up the Clone Wars really was, because at the end of the day, it was the Republic and the Separatist fighting against each other. But when the war was over, the Republic ceased to exist and the Separatists ceased to exist. Ultimately, the only person who won was Palpatine, because lo and behold, he was pitting both sides against each other. Yeah. And used this war just as a means to, you know, elevate himself up to being like emperor for life, basically. And
yeah.
You know, it's kind of satisfying to see how, you know, he's ultimately able to kind of find this truce where Rex, who's a Republic guy, and the tactical droid, the Separatist guy, they're thinking, okay, we now have this common enemy, the Empire. So let's declare a truce, and the war is over, and we'll fight back against these Imperial groups. And I mean, it still sucks that, like, the tactical droid, like, abandons them at the end, and we don't see what he goes on to do, but yeah, that was still great. And what makes that episode even better is that instead of giving us the normal end credits, they restylize the Rebels logo to look like the yellow
Clone Wars logo,
when yeah. they did the ending thing. Like, when that happened, I was all like, oh my god, yes, yes, yes. Like, I had a total fangasm when that thing happened.
Yeah, and, you know, to kind of talk about the greater point here, indirectly, and this is my personal take, and I don't think this is the normal fan take to the episode, but one thing that is subtly hinted at, and it's very subtle, is that, so, going back 20, 25, maybe 30 years ago, when the original trilogy was all we had, and I was a wee lad, I kind of had the impression that Palpatine's affiliation to the Sith Order was kind of common knowledge, and that's why the Empire was evil, and that's why we had a rebellion. But then when we start looking at the Clone Wars and you see his ascendance to Emperor status, you don't really get the feeling that people really know that he's a Sith. And this scene, when Ezra's talking about who won, the fact that he didn't know that Palpatine, the Emperor, was also the Sith Lord Palpatine, that's very fascinating to me. And it made me wonder for a little bit after, if they didn't know he's the Sith Lord, why was the rebellion formed? What conditions were that bad to force this? And it made me think a good bit. And my only explanation is, I think a lot of the people in the galaxy didn't like Palpatine assuming this much power after the emergency powers were given to him at the end of the Clone Wars. Because if you remember, he was given an extra term, then he was given special powers in a state of emergency, and he used the speech at the end of The Revenge of the Sith to show that we need an empire now, and I'm the emperor.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the rebellion was really formed as a protest to Palpatine assuming that much power. And then, yes, Palpatine did some crap stuff, and that was a flame to spark the rebellion's real birth.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the rebellion truly came from a political movement rather than a light versus dark side type thing. And I got all that from that one episode.
I mean, I kind of already had those types of thoughts just based on like some of the books that I've read that kind of try to, you know, like especially Lost Stars, which kind of tells, like, Lost Stars is about a book about like two like regular people whose planet gets annexed by the Empire, and they join the Academy, and we actually get to see them see a little bit of history from like Palpatine's perspective. Like, the war was started because Mace Windu, this thug, interfered with a legal execution or something. And like, you know, the history is told from like, you know, Palpatine was this brave, amazing man who ended the war while those stupid, evil, dumb Jedi couldn't end it. Like, and like, they don't know about like the dark versus light side. Like, they're just everyday people. And it's so I've always kind of viewed it like that.
Yeah, I mean, I viewed it like that too, you know, watching the Clone Wars, watching the Rebels. But it wasn't until I started thinking, okay, Ezra is asking who's the real winner here. But that sparked the question of, what did the Empire really do to all these people to make them hate them so much and cause the rebellion? And, you know, I found it interesting that it wasn't the light versus dark side theme that you normally would see in this type of situation. It was more of a political, we don't like this. It'd be akin to, and let's hope it never happens, but if, like, I don't know, Trump was to become a third term president, or he just never left office, and, you know, that'd be a similar type of thing. If people started rebelling against that, it'd be very akin to what's happening here in the galaxy.
Yep.
So, yeah, I just wanted to throw some light on that to discuss it a little bit, because I thought that was a very interesting piece of it.
Yeah, it's definitely taking a deeper look into it.
Some of the other stuff that I really enjoyed besides this episode and the Mandalorian stuff has to come from the Holocron stuff in the beginning, when Maul and Ezra kind of team up again to use the Holocrons to get the knowledge to figure out how to end the Sith and where Kenobi ended up. I thought it was interesting that both answers were the same thing, if with the twin star sons. Because the twin sons say, hey, Obi-Wan's on a planet with this, but also the key to destroying the Sith is on that same planet because Luke is there.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a pretty cool moment as well, when you realize what that hint really meant.
Mm-hmm. Should we now bring up that episode?
Yeah, I think so.
So yeah, this is the, this was, I had actually seen clips from this episode a long time before I actually watched Rebels, but we have the penultimate episode of this season, Twin Sons. So Maul arrives on Tatooine, you know, because all he has left now is just killing Obi-Wan. Like, that's literally all that he wants to do now. And Ezra, you know, goes to Tatooine, even though everybody tells him not to, because he wants to warn Obi-Wan, but then he gets knocked out in the desert, and then Obi-Wan finds him, and we get the big confrontation with Maul, where, well, first Obi-Wan, you know, gives Ezra, like, a lesson on how he doesn't need Ezra's help, and Ezra needs to be there with his family, basically. So it's, the spirit of the episode is still there with Ezra just, you know, caring about his family and going back, but the big thing is that we have our big fight between Maul and Obi-Wan, and this is, keep in mind, this is like I want to say like maybe two or three years before the Battle of Yavin. So this is like Alec Guinness Obi-Wan at this point. Although the design of Obi-Wan, though, they really did try to like design him to where you can still see a little bit of like the Ewan McGregor era Obi-Wan from like his design in the Clone Wars, but he's still aging into that Alec Guinness form. Like, I don't know, whoever drew that design is just a complete genius. They have their huge fight, and it's not a huge fight. A lot of people really complained at the time about how the duel is really short, like it only lasts a couple of seconds, but it's actually like, it's actually done in like a very amazing way. Like, Riz, you mind if I just like break this whole thing down? Or?
Dude, go for it. I've talked a lot.
Yeah. So Maul ignites his saber, one of his blades, and then, you know, he taunts Obi-Wan, and then Obi-Wan ignites his own saber, and he assumes his own stance. It's his form is called Sorasu. It's where he has he's holding his lightsaber in one hand, and it's up like he's holding his lightsaber horizontally, and the hilt is being held up next to his face. If you've seen Clone Wars, and he even uses that stance in Revenge of the Sith, then you'll know what I'm talking about. Then Maul ignites his blade, and he assumes his own stance. And then, all of a sudden, Obi-Wan shifts his stance. He shifts his stance to where he's holding it with two hands and holding it sideways. And this stance is called Ataru. Ataru, and this is very important, because this was the preferred lightsaber fighting style that Qui-Gon used. Now, during this pause, you can see Maul's eyes widen up a little bit, like, oh, I know what I'm going to do now. Like, you can see the gears turning in his head, like, oh, I see what I'm going to do. And then there's a pause, and then here's exactly what Maul tries to do. You see him shove the shaft of his lightsaber up. And remember, in The Phantom Menace, exactly how he killed Qui-Gon, he hit Qui-Gon in the face with the shaft of his lightsaber, which caused Qui-Gon to get stunned and stumble, and then that left Maul with an opening to stab Qui-Gon in the stomach. Maul can't resist the urge to take Obi-Wan out the same way that he took Qui-Gon out, but unfortunately, this is exactly what Obi-Wan was baiting him into doing. Obi-Wan knows exactly what he's going to do, and he's quick to slash down when Maul tries to hit him in the face. And that's it. Like, Obi-Wan knew what Maul was going to try to do, and Maul just played right into his hand. And it's like the ultimate, like chess match win. Like, I don't know. Like, that's one of the deepest lightsaber duels I've ever seen with how he finishes that. I know I'm one of those guys who probably pays too much attention to these types of details, but I don't know, whoever animated that duel, it was the most genius way to end it, in my opinion. Like, I don't care what everybody else says, like, it's a perfect lightsaber duel, in my opinion.
It shows the growth of Obi-Wan from, you know, episode one of the prequel trilogy until now, because Obi-Wan was a Padawan then, and he still was skilled enough at that point to even notice the techniques being used and the stances and the moves. And then he kept it in his mind throughout these years, recreating the moment that he lost Qui-Gon and thinking what could have been done differently to prevent that.
Yep.
And what he did to Maul is what he wanted to do desperately if he could go back in time. So it's kind of poetic that he was able to do it here. And honestly, this gives way more closure to Obi-Wan than even him giving Luke that little bit of training that he did give him in the original trilogy.
Yep.
And even more than him and Anakin fighting again in the A New Hope.
Mm-hmm.
I think this right here is the peak of Obi-Wan's story.
Yeah, and I think that to kind of go off of what you're saying, like the big thing that highlights it is their final bit of dialogue where Obi-Wan gives the final blow. He's killed Darth Maul. And then Maul is like, you know, dying in his arms. But Maul asks, like, are you protecting the Chosen One? And then Obi-Wan is like, yes, he is the Chosen One. And then Maul says, he will avenge us. And first of all, that's great on Maul because it once again shows that, like, he, even though he was not really, I don't like to say that Maul was evil at this point. He was just a horribly, like, broken person who just had nothing because, you know, he was, I said this in the previous video, well, a podcast about Rebels. He was used by Palpatine in his little chess game. And then the minute that he had no more use for Maul, he discarded Maul. Like, Maul had nothing left. Like, he was also an enemy of Palpatine. And to see him, like, know that the Chosen One will destroy the Sith, that's powerful. But the thing that always, like, that is the most powerful is that Obi-Wan looks genuinely sad when Maul dies and he closes Maul's eyes. That perfectly defines the kind of person that Obi-Wan is. Because remember what Maul did. Maul killed his master, who was like a father to him. Maul has always been going out of his way to try and kill him. And he killed the woman that Obi-Wan loved. And yet, despite all of that, despite all the horrible things that this guy did to him, Obi-Wan never hated Maul. He still always respected him. He probably buried Maul after that. Like, I think that perfectly defines just how Obi-Wan is always just someone who has always remained true to himself and nothing has ever broken him. Which is one of the reasons why Obi-Wan is still my favorite Jedi character of all time.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it's interesting that Maul asked him, is he the Chosen One and will you protect him and all that? Because I feel like it was either in season 7 or a season prior that Maul has some vision or inkling that Anakin will defect. And that leads to, you know, everything that's happened.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember when it happened, but I know there's something where Maul saw, like, this entire event happen, and he knew that there's somebody coming in the future that would be the real Chosen One.
Well, I do know that he did foresee Anakin turning to the dark side, and that's why he, like, that's where the whole story of the Siege of Mandalore came. Like, he didn't want, he wanted Anakin and Obi-Wan to show up to Mandalore, not Ahsoka.
Yeah.
Because if Anakin and Obi-Wan are there, then Palpatine can't turn Anakin to the dark side. I mean, the
that's
whole galaxy won't turn.
Yeah.
Like,
so it's interesting to me that he knew back then about Anakin. He tried to do something about it. And then flash forward to Rebels, and he's still consumed by it.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting to me that that's still a thing.
Well, he's more consumed for his desire to, like, get revenge on Obi-Wan, because, like, at this point, like, he failed in his, like, he's lost Mandalore.
Yep.
Because he was, like, the ruler of Mandalore for a little bit. His plan to foil Palpatine's plan to take over the galaxy completely failed. Like, literally hating Obi-Wan and getting revenge on Obi-Wan is all that he has left.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but I mean, even with that hatred, his last words were not, "You fought well, Obi-Wan." It was about the Chosen One. So even though Obi-Wan was the primary drive for what he did, because, yeah, he definitely lost his own, like, group of people that he was leading and creating, he lost favor with Palpatine. He was no longer the apprentice. He was no longer a Sith. All he had left was that Obi-Wan obsession, and somehow, hopefully, seeing his other person that really offended him, Palpatine, get what's due to him. And him knowing the Chosen One is out there, biding time until he's ready to take on Palpatine and Vader, is probably why Maul was able to die peacefully at the end.
Yep.
That's my thoughts on it.
Well, this was just the perfect closure for his character.
It was.
And I'm not sure how they explain, like, him coming back, like, of course, you know, with the Clone Wars series being considered, you know, canon and Legends as well, I'm not sure how they handle him being killed in Legends. I might have to go into that, but, like, I don't know, like, I know this may sound like a unpopular opinion, but I think there's a lot of things in the Legends continuity that's just completely convoluted and just, like, just doesn't make any sense. Like, this, in my opinion, is, like, the perfect, like, definitive closure for Darth Maul as a character.
Yeah.
Do we have any other favorite moments?
Not favorite moments, but just general comments now. About stuff that I thought was interesting. So, previously, last time we had a podcast on this for season 2, we talked about Ezra and the Purrgils and Ezra and the other Lothcats and everything else, and how he has this great affinity for talking to creatures and understanding them, right? Like, that was his Force specialty, as I put it. But something happened in this season that kind of bugged me. And that would be when Ezra is kind of flirting with the dark side, learning from the Sith Holocron. He has trouble relating with the spiders on Adalon.
Yeah, the Krykna spiders.
Like, he can't form a connection to them. He can't feel them. He can't communicate to them. And his connection to them is broken. And it shouldn't be, if what I said last time is true, that his Force specialty is dealing with these kind of animals and understanding them. And I think it's because he was kind of waning more towards the dark side here. So his ability to be that animal whisperer, as you may, was kind of diminished. And I know he'll get it back in the next season because there's some stuff that happens, but It's interesting that in this season he lost that a little bit. I mean, yeah, he gets it back with Click Clack and the Ghost of Xehanosis.
Yeah.
But we got to remember, that's after him and Maul have their falling out and Ezra realizes, okay, I can't be doing what I'm doing.
So you could argue that maybe it was, you know, it had something to do with just him embracing elements of the dark side.
It definitely was him embracing the dark side that led him to have that problem with the spiders. And when he stopped embracing it, we see proof of him able to talk to Click Clack and, you know, resolved a problem through communication, not through murder.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's a very interesting thing for Ezra's character and for just kind of how the Force and Jedi and Sith work in general. Because it implies that the more you give into the hate, the more you give into the dark side, the less you're able to tap into these light side qualities like communing with nature and feeling the Force around you.
Mm-hmm.
Because the light side is more about tranquility. It's more about peace and meditation and feeling the Force in everything around you. The dark side is more about using that power to get what you want, the consequences be damned. So it's a very interesting, subtle thing that they did in season 3 when they showed Ezra unable to do it, because that showed that he really was losing the connection to the light side.
Yep.
So I thought that was pretty interesting. I also think the Ghost of Geonosis has some other very interesting stuff that, unfortunately, the episode kind of dilutes the importance of with other stuff. But so to recap the episode real quick, Saw Gerrera, who is a member of the Rebellion, has gone missing on Geonosis, and we see him previously in one of the Clone Wars arcs with him and his sister when the Jedi are trying to militarize different local militias to help them fight so the Jedi don't always have to be there. And he lost his sister in that encounter. So the Ghost crew goes in to investigate what happened to Saw and his group, and they find... So they find a couple of things there, but the things that are really important is they find a Geonosian that they nicknamed Click-Clack, because all they can understand from him is Click-Clack. And they're trying to ask him several times, what was the Empire doing on Geonosis? And all Click-Clack can do is draw two circles in the dirt. Which, when, you know, a Star Wars fan sees that, immediately they're going to think of the Death Star. But they dilute it by also bringing up a plot point of Click-Clack having hidden a Geonosian egg deep within the planet. And the egg resembles the two circles as well. And the viewer is kind of hinted to think that's what he was trying to communicate, as he wanted to go back to his egg. He didn't want to be with them anymore. But I think Click-Clack was trying to hint more at they might have been manufacturing the Death Star on Geonosis.
Yeah, they do. They, at least in Legends, it was like, you know, said that, you know, Geonosis was one of the main areas where they built the Death Star. This is probably the first major piece in canon where they acknowledge that Geonosians were used as like the main labor of building the Death Star. They also hint that like Wookiee slaves were also used, but I think that was definitely the point that they were trying to get across.
Yeah, it was. And I didn't know about the Wookiee slaves or that the Geonosians were actually made to build the Death Star. I was assuming that they had, you know, maybe not stormtroopers, but people like the stormtroopers building the Death Star over there.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I thought it was an Empire-led effort. I didn't think that they had, like, slaves building it. But it makes sense either way. So, the emergence of the reference to the Death Star here, what, like, 2 years prior to A New Hope, I think? Are we 2 or 3 years away from it right now?
Hold on, let me check the timeline. It says that Yeah, two BBY. So yeah, 2 years before A New Hope.
Yeah. So I find it interesting that we're starting to see signs that a Death Star emerged 2 years prior, because that's roughly at least how long it takes to build one. It probably took way longer to build it with technology and all that, but that's the first hint we have of them building it chronologically.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's pretty important as well to bring up here.
They do hint that I think in terms like canon, like the earliest I can remember, the construction was like a secret project where only like a handful of people knew about it. It was the book Tarkin, which I can't remember what timeline that was, but it's definitely like long before A New Hope, because he's only an admiral or something in that book. Like, that book is all about him obtaining the role of Grand Moff. So yeah, it would be some time before this series, actually, because I'm pretty sure he's Grand Moff Tarkin by the time of season one of Rebels, I think.
Oh, I don't know. I have to go back and look again.
Okay. I would say that one thing that I love, like, interesting, and I kind of want to use this to segue into talking about characters, actually.
Okay.
I really want to start off with Grand Admiral Thrawn. The funny thing is that I read the Thrawn novel, not the Legends novel, like Thrawn's first appearance in canon, literally just before I started watching this season. And I think this series does justice to Thrawn. I don't remember much of what he did in the original Thrawn trilogy. I need to read those books again, but like, this guy is very true to like the core of what Thrawn is, where Thrawn is not like, if you've read the book, then you might know this, like Thrawn is not really an evil person, believe it or not. He believes that the Empire is flawed, but it's a necessary evil to maintain order. And that's why he does. Cause like, if you watch all the episodes that he's in, like, he never wants to do anything particularly cruel to our heroes. I mean, there's an episode where they're invading Ryloth, and like somebody wants to throw away one of Hera's family heirlooms, and he's all like, mm-hmm. "No, this is a valuable piece of art. I'm going to keep this. Like, how dare you try to trash a piece of Twilight culture?" Like, I like that about him. I think that this, you know, season does a really good job of like, you know, illustrating like the kind of person that Thrawn is, where, you know, he's not an evil person, but he views his battling his enemies not really as like a battle between good and evil, more like a friendly game of chess where he's going to do everything he can to win, but he's not going to do anything cruel to his opponents or anything.
Yeah.
And you know, we see he has a lot of pieces of art in his collection, because if you've read the book, like, you'll know, like, Thrawn is a major fan of art, because he believes that you can learn everything there is to know about your opponent through their art.
He's a philanthropist.
Yes. And I'm going to go over some funny pieces of his collection a little bit when we talk about some of the trivia for this, but I think that they did a good job at like really illustrating the kind of person that Thrawn is. And like, I don't know, like I think that they're true to who Thrawn was in the original Thrawn trilogy. Like, as someone who read those books, I approve of what Thrawn is
yeah.
in Rebels.
So I don't have that background on Thrawn that you have, but I will say that I can definitely see the brilliance of Thrawn and how he thinks and his strategy he brings up. Like, everything that could be seen as a defeat to him, he turns into a victory. Nate, are you familiar with gargoyles?
Yeah, of course.
You remember Xanatos?
Duh.
Okay. Thrawn is very Xanatos-like. they have a term that came from this, from Gargoyles, called Xanatos Gambit, which means even when Xanatos wins, he wins. But even when Xanatos loses, he loses. He wins, sorry. So, because everything that he's planned that far ahead, so he has a gambit for everything, is what you're trying to say. And Thrawn's the exact same way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I would love to find a space or a time to do one of those what-if scenarios, like a versus, to put Xanatos versus Thrawn and see who would win.
Yeah, I would need to watch Gargoyle. Like, it's been a long time since I watched that show, but I was a huge fan of it as a kid, so...
It's one of my favorite cartoons mm-hmm. from growing up.
But I can see the comparisons from what I remember of Xanatos.
Yeah, he reminds me of Xanatos so much. Like, every time... Like, even when... I think it was in Zero Hour, maybe, or one before that. He's looking at the trajectory. Oh, yeah. It was, because Kallus was trying to send a message to the rebels saying that they're coming to Adelon, but the message was kind of interrupted, so he couldn't get the whole message out. Well, Thrawn used the trajectory of the transmission in correlation with last known travel of the rebel fleets to pinpoint what planet that rebels were on. And I thought that was a brilliant use of his abilities and his mm-hmm. ability to deduce information from...
He's playing like 6D things. Chess.
Dude, he's playing 10D chess if you ask me.
Exactly.
Man, that was some big brain moves right there.
And I'm just looking forward to seeing the expansion of his character in Ahsoka.
Oh yeah, definitely. But yeah, Thrawn's an amazing character.
There is one character I want to get out of the way just because I don't know if this is an unpopular opinion, and this is kind of a spoiler alert for what I'm going to say in my Thrawn novel review. I'm not a fan of Governor Arinda Price. Like, we forgot to mention her. Like, first of all, her character design looks exactly like Colonel Dr. Spalko from Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which is a problem. But, like, I wasn't even introduced to her this season. I was introduced to her in the Thrawn novel, because the Thrawn novel shows how she ultimately reaches the rank of, like, Governor of Lothal. And I have to say that, like, every time the book switched to a chapter about her, like, there, it got to a point where sometimes I was just rolling my eyes. I'm like, really? I gotta get to her story again? Like, seriously? Like, I just think that she's just kind of boring. Like, there's not really much to her other than her just being like this merciless governor. Like, I don't know. Is that an unpopular opinion, Riz? Like, do you like Price?
I don't like Price.
Okay.
I kind of agree with you there.
I'm not a minority on that then. I feel
well. Good. You can't say you're not a minority based off of one other person's opinion.
Okay, but I'm not a minority in this podcast, thankfully.
Yeah.
I
wasn't really a big fan of Price. Like, she kind of felt pointless to me overall as a character. Like, she didn't really bring much to the table.
Mm-hmm. I do wish that this show had Thrawn's aide from his novel. His name is Eli Vanto, but I can kind of understand why they didn't show him. And you'll have to listen to my Thrawn review on that to kind of get more of an understanding.
Or I'm going to read the book.
Yeah. You know what? We've already talked to death about Sabine. I don't think we need to say anything more about Sabine.
No, Sabine's done. I want to talk about Kallus real quick first.
Yeah, go ahead.
So Kallus, last we saw him in season 2, he and Zeb had a really good bonding moment on the moon. On like a moon, an ice moon of, was it Geonosis? One of the planets.
Possibly. I can't remember.
I can't remember either. But he had a bonding moment with Zeb. And that kind of ended with him when he got back to his ship, realizing that nobody cared that he was gone or he was hurt or anything. And I think that's what led to him defecting, because for the entirety of season three, we have a new Fulcrum. It's not Ahsoka, because Ahsoka's been established to be gone. Well, Fulcrum is Callus, and Callus has been a double agent feeding info back to the rebels under the guise of Fulcrum. And there are multiple times in the season where somebody does something kind of stupid, hi Ezra, and ends up getting captured, and Callus manages to intervene and set them free to go on and return to the rebels when he shouldn't have, because he's an Imperial on paper. And you kind of see that hint throughout, like he's not the same anymore. And like, I know at one point he tries to tell them, this is to make me and Zeb equal or like even or whatever, but it's really because he was Fulcrum and he was on the rebellion side. And I thought that was a really good character development for him, because it makes him way more compelling than before. Because before, he was kind of just like a pain in the ass guy that was there to cause trouble for the rebels, but he wasn't really well fleshed out or thought out. But now he has a very interesting character.
Yeah, and like I like how they do have one of the major characters be like a former Imperial that was defected. Because I do know, like, I do remember reading a lot of like stuff and like, you know, not necessarily legend stuff, but just like some bios for like some rebel soldiers, like to give some examples, like Biggs in A New Hope, they established that like he went to the Imperial Academy and technically joined the Empire, but then he defected to the rebellion. And you know, all these people who apparently used to work for the Empire before defecting to the rebellion. And it's cool to like have one of those major characters. And I like how, you know, it's more of like a personal view of like him realizing like how he just feels like a pawn in a game in the Empire. And that's why he defects, as opposed to like the cliched, like a lot of people decided to defect from the Empire when they realized just how insane they were when they used the Death Star to blow up Alderaan. Like,
yeah.
And like genocided like billions, if not trillions of people. Like, I like how Callus is a bit more of a personal reason.
Yeah. No, Callus really, yeah, he had a personal reason. And I think he played the part really well.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I just wanted to touch on Callus and give him some props, because he definitely grew from last season.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
I wanted to bring up Kanan next.
I was going to say the same thing.
Okay, cool. You know, I remember when I was watching this, like before I started watching Rebels, I still occasionally watch some of Doug Walker's content, like, you know, Channel Awesome, and he did Rebels for his Disney Simber thing, and he was actually criticizing Kanan. Like, he thinks that Kanan, like, didn't like how they thought that, like, Kanan was just, like, broken and, like, you know, was, you know, pouting and everything after he becomes blind. And honestly, I don't see it. I think they handled him being blind at the beginning of the season pretty well. Like, because, you know, Doug likes to think, oh, well, you know, how does he not know how to use the Force to, like, see? And the explanation is, like, well, do you not know his backstory? Like, he was just a little kid when he was last undergoing, like, Jedi training with Depa Balaba. So it makes sense why he wouldn't know entirely how to, like, be able to see better, like, see without the Force at first. And I think they handled it great with him learning how to do that with Bindu. I do wish that maybe they had like maybe one or two more episodes that specifically revolved around him overcoming his blindness. But I mean, I think what they did was perfectly fine. You know, I love how he's training Sabine to use the Darksaber and everything. That, like, he plays a huge part in that arc, and that was great. I don't know. Kanan just came off as a much better mentor in this season, which is definitely a huge step up from where, you know, he was unsure of, like, how to... he was unsure of how to be a mentor to Ezra at first. So I think he took some definite steps forward this season.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I think Kanan had some very interesting themes throughout the season. I'm going back to the themes again. So in season one, he's trying to reconcile with the loss of the Jedi Order and his own mentor, Depa Bilaba. I think that sounds it's correctly said, yeah. Right?
Depa Bilaba.
Yeah, so trying to get over the loss of that and his own master, and reluctantly trying to teach Ezra to be a Jedi, while he himself being very uncertain of his abilities. And then he goes into season two not as unconfident in his abilities to train Ezra, because by the end of season one, he had started to overcome that fear he had enough that he was able to rise to the rank of Jedi Knight and be formally given that role. But then he had a new conflict now where he lost his sight. So he had to dig deeper into the Force to learn to navigate the world with just the Force, because he can no longer see the world. And I think even if he never gets officially canonized as a master, I think he's on a path to become on par with the Masters.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was pretty good development for him to continue to deepen his bond with the Force and hit that level. So, yeah, that was my Kanan opinion.
Yeah, I believe. Is there... Okay, I still love Hera, and I think she's a great character, but I don't really think that she did anything huge this season.
Okay, so I'll be honest with you. Hera and Zeb hadn't really done too much this season.
Now, there is one awesome moment that Hera has. It's the episode where the ISB hacks Chopper, and then she, just before she manages to get Chopper back, she says, "Hey, you keep your hands off my droid," before she like blows the ship up or something. And it's like, yeah, you don't mess with Hera's droid. Like, that was a badass moment.
I'm just saying, the amount of power she relayed through Chopper back to the Imperial, whatever, Star Destroyer or whatever that ship was, that should have destroyed the ghost.
Mm-hmm.
So, yay. I guess we can call this Star Wars magic.
Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, that was awesome. And, I mean, I don't want to insult Hera because she's still a great character, but I feel like everything that can be done with her has already been done by the time this season has happened.
The only thing that's really interesting here is the episode where she goes to get the Calicor.
Yeah, from Ryloth?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember that.
That was an interesting episode. I thought it added some, you know, some more lore to her. But it wasn't enough to make it, like, super memorable. Like,
I mean, I think she's going to be a lot better next season, but we'll get to that later.
I mean, yeah, there's a lot of reasons for that.
Mm-hmm.
but yeah, no, I think Hera was... She didn't deteriorate. She didn't improve. She just stayed her awesome badass self.
Mm-hmm.
So, want to move on to Zeb?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think Zeb really did much this season either.
No, he's still the same old Zeb. He has his little quirks and quips with the group, and that's about it.
I remember one episode where he's, like, in charge of the base, and he has to stop this droid from blowing up, but...
Oh, that was so fun.
Yeah. But... And I like how, you know, he and Chopper still continue to, like, have this, I hate you, but I can't live without you, buddy, like, type of thing. So, yeah, I think his character kind of hit his peak in story previous season.
Yeah.
Still a great character, but not much to talk about with him.
I think the only other character remaining is AP5.
Who's just still he and Chopper are still just their funny selves.
But I don't think we really talked about AP5 all that much last time. But I do want to highlight here some interesting things about AP5 that I noticed subtly about just who he is. So I've always found it interesting that he was able to defect from the Empire, which implies that these droids in Star Wars have some level of free will beyond the programming that they're given by their creator. Because if the droids were more program-based without free will, he would never have defected last season, and he'd never have been as efficient at doing his job here on the Rebel base at Adelon as he is, despite all that. So I just want to call out how cool that is to me that AP5 was able to decide on his own, screw this, the Empire sucks, I'm out.
Yeah, now he's like one of the sassier, like, deadpan characters, and I absolutely love it.
He's amazing.
See where he's floating out in space by himself, and he's just singing a song to himself, and then the people show up, and he's like, oh no, can't I just be at peace? That's hilarious.
Okay, I don't know if you've ever watched this, but AP5 has very mild Sheldon Cooper vibes from the Big Bang Theory.
Yeah, I can see that.
And I just love his banter with Chopper so much. Like, he kind of fills the void of C-3PO, and we kind of get that dynamic of R2 and C-3PO from the OT and, well, really all the trilogies.
Yep.
With this one. So I thought that was a pretty nice callback to other characters. But they're also unique enough that we don't just think of them as the Rebels' version of C-3PO and R2-D2, because Chopper is way too
sassy to be R2.
Yeah. And AP5 is way too deadpan to be C-3PO, because C-3PO is more neurotic than that.
Yeah, and C-3PO is more of a coward, I guess you could say.
Yeah, I just wanted to call out that. I thought that was pretty interesting to me. Besides that, I mean, is there any characters that we're forgetting?
There are some... I did want to go over a list of, like, some of the, you know, characters from the movies that we kind of see some side appearances of as part of, like, the connections and trivia.
Yeah, go for it.
That's about it. Okay, so like we say, we do see General Jen Dodonna this season. He's going to appear in a couple of other... He's going to appear next season as well. He was... he originally appeared in A New Hope as the commander of the Rebel base on Yavin 4, and he was also in Rogue One as well. The episode where we actually see, like, the rebellion be born, like, when Mon Mothma declares the rebellion, we actually see Rebel pilot John Vander. Vander, he appears as a... He's not referred to by his nickname that in the episode, but his nickname is Dutch. I'm not sure. They don't even try to explain why he has that nickname, but he was referred to by that nickname in A New Hope. He is a Y-Wing pilot, and he was actually Gold Leader in A New Hope, and by extension, he is Gold Leader in Rogue One as well, since stock footage is used of him, and unfortunately, Vander is going to die at the hands of Darth Vader during the very first trench run in the Battle of Yavin. So when Sabine, in the episode The Antilles Extraction, where Sabine recruits Wedge from the Starstrike Academy, everyone knows who Wedge is. I mean, if you don't know who Wedge is, you're not a Star Wars fan. But the other person who is recruited alongside Wedge, his name is Derek Clivian. His nickname is Hobby. Hobby is a pilot that we see in The Empire Strikes Back. He's one of the pilots of the Hoth base. He has one line in the movie where Leia's briefing how the escape is going to be planned out, and he questions Leia's logic to, quote-unquote, pit two fighters against a Star Destroyer in that. And he fights in the Battle of Hoth. We can hear Luke frequently call out to him during the battle. Now, unfortunately, Hobby is also going to die in the Battle of Hoth. We don't see this on screen, and this apparently wasn't considered canon in Legends, but apparently Disney considers it canon. There was a deleted scene where he loses control of his snowspeeder and he crashes it into the head of the leading AT-AT led by General Veers, which, you know, results in the destruction of the walker. The scene was cut from the movie, but it appears in the film's novelization and is considered canon. Oh, and now here's a funny thing. Apparently the original script of The Antilles Extraction, the pilot that Sabine was going to be recruiting was actually going to be Luke's friend, Biggs Darklighter. Mm-hmm. But they decided that it wasn't going to work because there's a deleted scene in A New Hope that establishes Biggs's backstory as, you know, in A New Hope. And they thought that having Biggs in this episode would conflict with it. So they switched him to Wedge. So that was pretty cool. Mon Mothma appears. She is voiced by Genevieve. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing that name. O'Reilly. And this is another example of a character being voiced by an actress in animation who played her in live action. This actress played a younger version of Mon Mothma in Revenge of the Sith, although her scenes were cut. And she is also Mon Mothma in both Rogue One and Andor. I just love it. It's like when Katie Sackhoff plays Bo-Katan in live action. It's absolutely cool. That's it for the characters that appear, but there's two other fun pieces of trivia I want to bring up. I told this to Riz. So the side ship of the Ghost called the Phantom, it gets destroyed this season. Well, there was a writer who suggested that they have it destroyed, and I don't know what the writer's name is, but apparently for the remainder of the show's production, they gave the writer a nickname, the Phantom Menace, from that point forward. That's just so perfect.
It is.
And one other thing, like I said, there's pieces of we're shown like pieces of Thrawn's collection. Now, there's a lot of assorted pieces, but the two things that stood out to me is that there's a cup that bears a very uncanny resemblance to the Holy Grail that we see in Indiana Jones in The Last Crusade, which is, that's insane. And there's also a clone trooper helmet that that looks almost exactly like Commander Gree's helmet that we see in Revenge of the Sith. That mm-hmm. was pretty cool. I don't know. The Holy Grail thing. I mean, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade is my favorite Indiana Jones movie, so I love that reference.
So also another interesting cameo in Twin Suns. Mm-hmm. When we see Luke in the distance, you also hear Beru Lars, who is Luke's aunt,
Yep.
And the audio used is actually archive audio of Selah Fraser, who played Beru Lard in New Hope.
Yeah, that was pretty cool.
Yeah. So, just want to call it out real quick.
One other thing, this was a book that I told Riz about, Shadows of the Empire. There's actually a bit of a reference here, because there's an episode where we meet a crew called Iron Squadron. They're flying around in a freighter, and it is a YT-2400 freighter. The design is basically based off of the Outrider. The Outrider is the personal ship of a major character in the Shadows of the Empire book. I'll go into more detail when I do my Shadows of the Empire novel review, but I thought that was pretty cool because I'm a huge fan of Shadows of the Empire.
Yeah.
Aside from that, though, there's not many other references or cameos that I could think of. I mean,
Well, Hondo is a big one.
Well, yeah, but Hondo is a huge character, so.
Hondo had a couple of really fun episodes in Dispatch as well.
Mm-hmm. I do wish that the Antilles instruction maybe showed us some other pilots get recruited. Like, I don't know, I would have liked to see Jack Porkins maybe in mm-hmm. one episode, or I don't know, maybe the only other one I can think of is maybe Luke's gunner from the Battle of Hoth, Dak Rendar, or I don't know what his last name was, but the only other guy was Wedge. That I remember by name is Wes Jensen, who is Wedge's gunner during the Battle of Hoth and Empire. I wish that they recruited more than just Wedge, but I mean, it's still cool to see Wedge. Oh, and by the way, Wedge is voiced by the guy who played Freddy in iCarly, Nathan Kress. That's pretty crazy. That is absolutely cool, though.
It is. So, you know what we didn't do?
What's that?
I don't think we really gave... Well, okay, I know we talked about Ezra throughout the podcast, but we didn't really do like a breakdown of him at the end. Do you have any thoughts on Ezra that we hadn't covered?
I thought we covered him pretty good. Like, I think they handled the whole... I do wish that maybe they kind of did the part where he like breaks away from Maul and like wanting to use the Sith Holocron a little bit later in the show, in the series, but... For what we got, I thought that Ezra was like perfectly fine. Like there wasn't really much to, there's not really much to talk about with Ezra. I think he's a much better character this season, and I think we highlighted everything that's awesome about him already.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that we did our fair, you know, credit to Ezra as one of the main characters mm-hmm. and talk about him briefly. But yeah, I have nothing else to add on Ezra here.
So you want to give overall thoughts?
Yeah, overall thoughts, like I said in the beginning, this is my favorite season as of the moment. I will reserve the right to change my opinion on the best season after I finish season 4 again. But as it stands right now, it goes season 3.
Yeah, and I just find it so ironic how, you know, this is the penultimate season of Rebels and it's my favorite, because it's the same with Clone Wars. Like Clone Wars season 5, which is the penultimate season, is my favorite season of Clone Wars. So kind of a weird coincidence, but I would say it like, and I can say this definitively, you know, since I've seen season 4, not that I hate season 4, I don't, but I just feel like this season has a lot of much more iconic and just deep moments. Like almost all the iconic moments I can think of from Rebels, I would think of from this season. So it's just great. You know, I think this is where I feel like the show is, like I said earlier, like this is where the show has finally found its footing, where it doesn't feel the need to lean on older characters, because like I said, we don't see Ahsoka, we don't see Vader. Rex is in the show, but he's only in like a handful of episodes. And sure, Maul is a big character, but this show brings finality to his character, so it's perfectly acceptable. And you know, that's why I like, I mean, I can't like, aside from maybe that one thing that you brought up about how Maul somehow has the Darksaber on like that other planet, like that didn't really bother me because I thought that there were like some explanations I could think of. Like, I really can't think of anything wrong with this season. Like, this is probably like, this is a perfect season in my opinion. Like, even the ending that ends on a more bittersweet note where they're forced to retreat from their base. Like, there were legitimate moments where I was watching the season where I'm on the edge of my seat wondering what's going to happen. And
well, we know it's going to happen.
Well, yeah, but
yeah.
But I fear for my characters because as previous animated series have shown, like, just because these people are main characters doesn't mean that they're going to live. I mean, everybody probably went through all of Clone Wars thinking that Echo and Fives were going to live throughout the whole series, and then they both died. Well, okay, Echo is kind of a different ordeal.
Echo's a special case.
Yeah, you get what I mean about Echo, though. Yeah. So, like, so that's why, I mean, you know, you can never be too confident that a main character is going to come out the other end of a season still alive.
Yeah.
And
next time we talk, there will be something that'll be touching on that.
Yeah, exactly.
So,
but that's why I don't normally give this type of score, and you guys will know it if you watch the Tokyo Secrets podcast. But in this case, I'm going to make an exception. Like, this is a perfect series. Like, there was nothing wrong with it. I'm going to give it a 10 out of 10 this season.
Yeah, I hate giving 10s, but I really have nothing to deduct points on here.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a 10.
Yeah.
And I think this is amazing buildup to give us more context on what happens in the Rebellion. And I'm excited to, you know, to rewatch season 4 and do our final season review prior to Ahsoka, which comes out in, I think, 2 weeks from today.
Yep.
From today's recording, at least. Because it comes out on the 23rd, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And today, for the viewers back home, it's the 9th of August, 2023. This podcast will get posted on the 11th, so take that as you will, but yeah.
So, any other closing thoughts?
No, close it out, man.
All right. Well, next time we'll be doing our... Riz and I will be together to do our Season 4 review ahead of us doing our weekly Ahsoka reviews. I still do have a couple of novel reviews kind of backlog that, you know, I'm going to get to, and I'm also planning to get through to another few novels. There are a few novel reviews that I've read that I want to hold off on just because I really want Riz to be in with me. I especially want Riz to be with me when we do Dark Disciple, which I want to hold off until we do Clone Wars. But aside from that, you know, that's what you can look forward to seeing on the Tokyo Secrets podcast.
Jedi Squadron podcast.
Sorry.
We have too many podcasts. We can't keep track anymore.
Right. That's
all will become Anime Secrets at the end anyway.
But with that said, we thank everybody who's listening to us on iTunes and Spotify. And if you're watching this on YouTube, give us your thoughts on season 3 down below. And, you know, if you're one of those fans who may have had some more like things that you didn't like about this season, go ahead and, like, you know, let us know, because, you know, we like to respond to your comments, and, you know, we'll be civil. Yeah. We always like to take all different kinds of points of view, you know, into account when we go on this podcast, and we'll give your comment a shout out. You know, if you have any novels that you want me to review, like I said, in all my novel reviews, please let me know. If I've read it already, I'll review it immediately. And if not, then I'll make reading some of those novels a top priority. But with that said, we thank you guys so much for taking the time to listen to us. And we'll see you guys next time when we take a look at Rebels Season 4. But until that time, you guys stay safe. We love you. And may the Force be with you.